Hey kids, before we get to a fresh episode of the Hashtag Am Writing podcast, I've got a thought for you. Are you the go-to in your writer's group for the kind of constructive criticism that people say helps them level up while still feeling like they're in charge? Has it kinda maybe occurred to you that you could get paid for that work, but you're not sure you're fully prepared or that you know how to get started? If that all sounds like you, you need to head over to bookcoaches.com/amwriting because Author Accelerator has a fantastic book coach training program that just might lead you to a side gig or a full-time business. You'll find all the info you need at bookcoaches.com/amwriting, along with frequently asked questions and a free video series to help you decide if book coaching is right for you. It's KJ, and I want to tell you about another podcast we think you might like to check out, Bookable. Every reader wants to know what to read next, and Bookable is dedicated to answering that question through short interviews with authors. And it also feeds our writerly urge to hear deep dives into how the work came to be. It's fun and engaging, with a fresh vibe and a host, Amanda Stern, who is known for her much-missed live New York City book events. Find new episodes every Sunday by subscribing to Bookable on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to Hashtag Am Writing.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause and...
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia and... this is Hashtag Am Writing, the podcast about writing all the things, so many things, fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, essays, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. I am the author of the book How to Be a Happier Parent, as well as the novel The Chicken Sisters, which will be coming out this December. I hope. Thank you, pandemic. I'm also the former editor and lead writer for the Motherload blog at the New York Times, where I'm still an occasional contributor, a little less often these days than previously.
And hello, I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming The Addiction Inoculation, coming out in April of 2021. Thank you, pandemic. And I'm also writing these days for the Washington Post and Airmail.
And we have a guest today. I am super delighted to welcome our friend Celeste Headlee. She is a speaker, author, and NPR journalist, and one of our favorite people to hang out with at conferences. That is, when we are going to conferences, because of her wicked sense of humor and willingness to let it fly. Her books include two manifestos, We Need to Talk, A Call to Have More, Better, and Sometimes More Difficult Conversations, and The Current Do Nothing, A Guide to Working Smart Instead of Working All the Time, that we are particularly in need of now that everyone's work has invaded every aspect of their lives, and everyone's life have invaded every aspect of their work. She is also the author of Herd Mentality, which is a great guide to creating a professional podcast/radio show, and one that we have referred to time and time again. So, hi, Celeste, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Pandemic okay.
Pandemic okay.
You gave me that answer. Celeste gave me that answer while we were getting ready to talk. So that's our new answer to that question at all times.
Yeah,
I am pandemic fine.
Yeah. Yep.
One of my very favorite moments with Celeste is I saved this video in my favorites folder because every once in a while I look at it. Celeste and I were doing a book signing together one time, and you know, it had been going pretty well. We'd been signing books. We even at one point had a little line. And then one of the Real Housewives of New York was signing her book, the Skinny Cocktail Person.
It's possible I took this video.
No, I took this one because the Skinny Cocktail Woman was signing books, and she had like a line that probably would have taken like 3 hours to get through. And so I sort of scanned across the entire line, and, you know, her security guards managing her line, and then went over to my little area with the Jessica Leahy thing and Celeste's little area with the Celeste thing. And we had no line, but we were having a lovely time not signing books that day next door to the Real Housewife of New York, who I don't even know what her book was about, but either way.
Well, who I'm... I might add, got up and left at the end of her hour.
She did.
With a line still there. So, I mean, you know, maybe you have to do that if that's who you are. But, yeah.
When you're in charge of making that many skinny cocktails, I guess that's what you have to do sometimes.
It's a lot of skinny cocktails.
Yeah.
Well, it's not why we're here. We're not here to talk about skinny cocktails.
It's a great
tempting,
story.
Yeah. Tempting though they might be. Celeste, before we even sort of embark on books and having good conversations and stuff like that, I just wanted to hear, what are you doing now in terms of, like, what is your work life and your writing life look like at the moment?
So I am working on a third book unexpectedly. I don't know how you guys do this, but I every time I finish a book, I'm like, okay, I'm going to take a year off of writing books. And then that never happens. So I'm working on a book about how to talk about racism. Not all the books that I've seen so far on how to talk about racism are really educating you on racism. You know, what is privilege, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all super important. This is not about that. This is like step by step. What does science tell us about how to have conversations about core issues without getting angry and storming off? So yeah, that's what this book is about.
That sounds great. I am in need of that one. I think that we all are. It is hard not to get heated. Yeah. It's just hard times, hard times.
Yeah, it is.
So when you look at your day, when are you getting your writing done and when are you focusing on other things?
My writing always is in the morning, pretty much. I rarely work in the afternoons. I'm really good at using my focus time. That I only have like 4 hours of focus a day. It's something I explained in the most recent book. And so I can get that done in the morning. So like I get up, I take my dog for a pretty long walk, about 45 minutes. I do my meditation. And sometime if it's a workout day, a workout. And then I get a cup of coffee and I sit down and I write. And sometimes, you know, you get in the flow and the hours just sort of fly by and I raise my head up and realize it's like noon. Because I wake up at somewhere between 5:30 and 6:30 every day. But some days it's a slog, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to kind of force yourself to keep going. And then once lunch is over, I usually get on with all my other stuff I gotta do.
So is this something that you have changed since pinning Do Nothing? Or, yeah, I mean, it must be. So tell us tell me what it looked like before the revelation and the subsequent writing of a book that causes you to put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, before I thought you could knuckle down. Like I thought you could force yourself to just keep working. And you can, but the work is not great. It was during the writing of that book that I realized that if I work with my brain's proclivities instead of against them, the work is easier. I mean, it's never easy, but it's way easier in that if I restrict my writing hours to the time per day that I have to focus and then walk away, I will get it done. It feels like that means that you're less productive, but what I have found is that I've actually been way more productive since I've reduced my working hours. Way more productive. I just get more done. And it's super counterintuitive. And I know it sounds like I'm selling you, a bag of cocaine or something ridiculous, but it is totally true that our brains are so beautifully designed to do creative work and critical thinking that if we stop hammering away at them, they work quite well, actually.
So what did the less productive, like, hours look? What did it look like when you were putting in more time and not getting as much done?
Yeah, I mean, then I was just like, I felt guilty if I was sitting there and not doing something productive. You know, even if I was watching a movie, I was checking my email and my social media feed, or I'd be like, oh, I can get some of these emails out while I watch episodes of Parks and Rec or something. And I would like rush back. I'd take my dog out for a walk and rush back so I could make sure I didn't miss anything. And I would take my phone with me when I was out for a walk, and I would check my phone first thing in the morning. And it was just every single day I was trying to leverage. I felt as though I had so much work to do that I couldn't I didn't have time to waste.
So I am doing that now, but it's not about work. It's about like this sort of desperate craving to have the news fulfill some function of making me feel better, which, gee, it's really not. And yeah. I'm right in the middle of like, I've just put limits on my phone and done all kinds of things around trying to push myself to do the things I actually want to do instead of like, I just read an exciting article about a Netflix poster for some movie that's offended everyone. And I don't care about any of it. Like, how did I get? And I know actually the answer to how I got there is you, because it came off of Salon. Oh, and I was looking up a talk you had given on Salon. So that one's down for you. But I want to know, did you have to put structures in place to sort of stop yourself? How did you get started with slowing down?
Oh, I absolutely had to. So you have to remember that most of us at this point are literally addicted. And so you have to treat this as though this is an addiction that you're trying to break, because we're all dopamine addicted at this point. Every time you click on an internet link, every time you open up your email inbox, every time you refresh your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed, you get a tiny little shot of dopamine and it feels awesome. I mean, it's not called the addiction hormone for nothing, right?
Right.
So we are all addicted to that substance at that point. And I think I probably still am as well. I'm just maybe a little further down the road toward healing than others are. And so you have to put some limits in place and you have to start one at a time. So in other words, you know, they always say going cold turkey doesn't help. So you just choose one thing, one limitation. You know, for some people it's as bad, I'll tell them, take a 10-minute walk without your phone. Get to the point where you can leave the house without it. Because for some people, that's how bad it is. But you have to choose yourself. What is the one step I can take right now that not only can I do successfully, but I can stick to it?
Mm-hmm.
And start there.
I have a list. Yeah,
well, can I interject one quick thing, which is that in the short term, what's been helping me is I've been trying to value the seasonality of to back up one second. The one thing I love about maple sugaring in New England is that you have to do it when it happens. Like there's no, oh, I'll just wait to, you know, boil that sap later because, you know, the trees will hold. That's not how the maple sugaring season works in New England. And there's something that's always been really appealing about that for me, which is everything else has to stop in order to do that thing. And for me, I can see summer is sort of starting to wind down and there's going to come a time when I can't be outside, you know, messing around in the garden, and the seasons are going to change and I'm going to be wishing for this time. And so I'm really determined to not let this time pass without taking advantage of it and letting it feed me, because right now I need whatever I can get to feed my soul and make me feel better. And so there have been a few days this week where I'm like, I've got too much to do right now. I have to keep my butt in the chair at the desk and just get it all done. And then I feel really bad at the end of the day. And I feel like I've wasted opportunities to also feed that other side of myself. So having that small reminder when I look out the window and I say, okay, it's getting late in the day, the sun is going to go down. And if I'm going to feed that other part of myself and not wish, you know, in 3 months that I had done more of it, I have to do it now. And so for me, that's been a nice reminder of the fact that the things that are happening today, I need to take advantage of rather than letting them pass until tomorrow or figuring I'll get to it tomorrow.
Yeah, you have to keep in mind, we all have this in the back of our minds that if we just work a little longer today, we'll get through that to-do list, right?
And then we won't do it tomorrow, but...
Right, but the thing is that list, it never ends. You never get to the end of that list. When you get some more, let's say you get 5 more tasks done today than you did on average, you'll just add more tomorrow. It's just a treadmill. That's all that it is. And the other thing to remind people of is that human beings had a slower pace for almost all of the 300,000 years that Homo sapiens has been on this planet. And it's not going to fall apart if we slow down to our biologically natural pace.
It's just so hard to recognize that you can probably both can probably do it tomorrow and will actually do it tomorrow if it needs to be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, not everything needs to be done. But how do you pick the things that do need to be done?
I just go on deadlines, right? I mean, I've gotten, after all the personal experimentation that I did while writing Do Nothing, I mean, because basically I wanted to find the science first, and then I would experiment on myself and see if it worked. And after all of that, I've gotten very good now at knowing what I can get done in a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
I can split my day up into half hours, and I can say, okay, this is the list of tasks that I can reasonably get done today. And that's what I do. I write a list of tasks, and if there are some that have to be done today because they're on deadline, and there are way fewer of those than you think, I put a star next to them, and those get done first. And if I don't get everything done that I thought I could get done, I just move it to tomorrow, and I end my day anyway.
Now I'm feeling like this is for your afternoon. Like,
this is sometimes for the morning. Like, sometimes I'll say, you know, okay, so for recently, for this book that I'm working on, I had to get my proposal in, and my agent said she's wants to have it by this date at midday, and that means I need it the day before at midday, so here's your deadline. And so, yeah, I buckled down and I spent those 2 days just writing, right? Because I was on deadline and everything else fell by the wayside. And, you know, it's interesting when those days occur, all that other stuff I was supposed to get done, and I thought the world would, you know, collide with the moon if I did not get them done, they had to be delayed because I had to focus on the proposal. And yet everything's fine. At the last I checked, the world was still okay. I mean, pandemic okay.
It's really not. And I didn't know who to blame until now.
Right, exactly.
Clearly, it's all Celeste's fault because she took those things off her to-do list.
Right, exactly.
Fix world, make vaccine, solve pandemic. Yeah. Check those off.
Yeah, we get these catastrophic, extreme ideas about what will happen. And I don't think we even articulate them to ourselves. You know, if we were to say to ourselves, what's going on in the background of our heads, if we were to say that out loud, if I don't get all these things done by 3 o'clock today, the world will end. If we said that out loud, we'd sound ridiculous. But that is the background music in our heads.
Yeah, it feels bad, and yet we still get into this cycle, or at least I do, of putting too many things down that I, you know, I'm setting myself up for failure. And I have to say, the reason that I think that, you know, Do Nothing is just as important, if not more important, now that we're all at home and arguably doing a lot more nothing, is I was actually fine before. Like, I had a grip on the phone and the deadlines and the not making more things on my list than, but now, I don't know, my brain is just not working as well as it used to work, probably due to all the time it has to spend frantically trying to check off things like solve pandemic, save world, which is not my job and is never going to be my job. But, you know, who is going to do that is definitely like a constant path in my head. So yeah, I'm struggling more now than I was a year ago, definitely.
Yeah, and so far the statistics bear that out. I mean, it turns out that in overall, the workday has gotten almost an hour longer, and we have more meetings than we did before the pandemic.
And I would imagine we're getting a hell of a lot less done.
Yes.
Sure feels that way to me. I mean, I often get up at the end of the day and go, dang,
yeah.
What did I do? I don't even remember.
Yeah, I do not have the data because we're in a pandemic. I can't study it, but I feel pretty confident in predicting that we are less productive. We are working more and less productive.
What's feeling bad to me is not, I'm still getting things done, but the things that I'm getting done are not as meaningful to me. I have felt really hopeless and like I'm not being as helpful. I'm not doing meaningful things, whether it's because I'm not teaching, I think is the main problem for me. I'm not getting that connection with other people that I'm helping them and they're right there in front of me. And so I get to the end of my day and I say, I know I got stuff done, but I didn't get anything like meaningful done today. So I've been trying to shift my focus from, you know, getting a lot of stupid little things done to getting at least one thing done that is meaningful and will help someone else. And that has that has made me feel better. And so when my husband comes home from actually, and I think this is part of the problem, is he's at the hospital saving people's lives, and I'm at home, I don't know, messing around on Twitter, I guess. I don't even know. So if I get at least one thing where I feel like I have been helpful to someone else, that makes me feel a lot better about my productivity during the day.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of benefits from doing something nice for somebody else. It's one of the things I talk about in the book. It's going to help you break the dopamine addiction, because when you have one of these other hormones, one of these other feel-good hormones that sort of lifts your mood, you're not as reliant on dopamine. And that helper's high that you feel when you help someone is a real thing. And it's way lasts longer than dopamine does. And it can help you break an addiction.
Well, I want to use that to talk about your other specialty, which is conversations. Because having a really good conversation with a friend or a family member, I would think, is another, you know, non-dopamine way to feel good. And I was wondering what you're doing right now to try to have more meaningful conversations with the people around you than just mechanics. Everything is so about like when and where and how.
I mean, the first thing is I'm really trying to limit Zoom. Zoom is great, and I have long recommended video conferencing, especially for people who work, you know, around the world from somebody else. But Zoom can also be quite exhausting, and it creates this cognitive problem, which is the delusion of eye contact, which is quite confusing to our brains. So Zoom is great, but you have to be careful with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing, is I am really trying to myself embrace my phone. Not that I have trouble with that anyway. I'm always going to be that friend that irritates you by leaving voicemails instead of texting. But the phone is so healing to me, and can be to other people if they stop hating it. So that's one thing. I've just become a little bit more strategic. I don't want to say strategic, but I guess thoughtful about when I have conversations and for how long. I just find I'm at such a basic level of stress and anxiety right now that I'm thinking carefully about what time of day I might be ready to have to be able to relax and sort of let go and be present for a conversation, what location I should be in, and how often I can do that per day. And it's just made it better.
Yeah, I have found, I did not think about that with respect to Zoom. I never thought about the eye contact with respect to Zoom or FaceTime, which my parents are particular fans of for some reason. I would so much rather talk to them on the phone for a lot of reasons. And I think some of it is just that when your brain is in phone mode, you don't expect to have.
Right.
Yeah. And also, plus you can wash dishes, which... it's harder to do on Zoom. But no, I am finding like setting an appointment for a phone call with a friend who is always like a nourishing conversation is super helpful. And then I'm finding some friends that are unexpectedly like it doesn't
depleting, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I hate to say it, but it's true.
I took a cue from my older son. I had actually posted something on Twitter a long time ago because it cracked me up. My older son, since he was little, he paces when he's on the phone. And now that we live in the woods, he actually goes out in the woods and he looked like Bigfoot traipsing through the woods. Like there was this weird hulking, you know, young 20-ish year old hulking through the woods on a phone having a conversation. So yesterday I tried to copy him and I went out in the woods and had a conversation with someone, and it was so nourishing because not only was I pacing out in the woods, I was having an actual conversation with someone, which felt like so much more than I've had in terms of contact with people recently. And I thought I hated the telephone, but I was very happy to be proven wrong yesterday.
Yeah, a lot of people think they hate the telephone, but when people study it, and the brain's reaction to it. You may think you hate it, but your brain and body very much enjoy it.
I think what I hate about the telephone is the fact that it feels like someone could call me at any time and they're stealing my choice away. It's like, I have to deal with this right now. But when I'm choosing to make that, you know, that connection with someone, it feels like a very nourishing thing for me. At least it did yesterday. So I think I'm going to try to repeat that and maybe have a few more phone conversations.
Yeah, I do think that being intentional about when you answer the phone, but you know what? It can't just be the phone either, right? I mean, this is what I hate about texting. People will text me at 9 o'clock at night, and I used to not shut off my phone, or I'd have my phone right next to my bed because I'm like, what if someone texts me? Until I started saying, okay, what if someone does text me? If they're texting me at 11 o'clock at night, unless it's an emergency, in which case they know to call me, that's not okay. Like, they don't get to intrude in my sleep that way. So my phone lives in the other room. It's not nowhere near me when I'm sleeping.
Mine is on Do Not Disturb, which has really made, I love Do Not Disturb.
Me too. Yeah. And I think that reclaiming our time, not reclaiming our time, I don't mean to, quote our Congress people, but to reclaim our environment and be more selective about when people can intrude and how, I think it's empowering.
I reclaimed our bedroom yesterday by saying we're just putting the phones down because we had gotten into the doom scrolling, you know, right before bed, you know, you do the doom scrolling, yeah. And we'd gotten a little dependent on that. And I realized I hadn't spoken to my husband in the past hour because we were both doom scrolling on our phones, and I was like, this isn't good, this doesn't feel good. So we last night I put my foot down and I said, we gotta actually talk to each other.
I actually crawled into the screen time feature, which I guess is really intended for you to limit your kids, and limited myself. So at this point, if it's after 8 o'clock and I try to text someone, it says, you cannot communicate with... Actually, it was a problem because my agent called me last night and I tried to call her back and it was like, you cannot communicate with this person after 8 o'clock. And I was like, oh no, yeah, actually I can. So fortunately, I am the adult in this situation. But other than that, I wanted to say, you know, you cannot communicate. You cannot look at this app. You cannot, and that's, I'll see how it goes. I mean, ask me in a week. But yeah, it feels good to have set some things up.
I would love to have listened in with that communication with your agent. I'm sorry, but I inadvertently blocked you on my screen time feature. I'm not allowed to talk to you after 8 o'clock.
It did take me a while to call her back. I was like, yeah, I had to fight through my own limitations to have this conversation. But it worked out.
I've said this before, but one of the things I respect most about the agent that KJ and I share is that she never responds to, unless it's, you know, some kind of crazy emergency. I don't think we've ever communicated over a weekend because that's for her family and she just doesn't. And I, far from feeling put upon about that, I love it about her.
Yeah. It is. I respect it too.
Yeah.
Gotta awesome. Respect that. Well, so one other topic that I wanted to hit is you're such a pro at the interview, the art of the interview, the art of the conversation. And I wondered if you had anything that you would offer our listeners for those moments when they are doing the thing on the phone, which is hard. I think we can all agree that even, you know, when you've lined up the researcher or the expert and now you're going to talk to them about your topic and you are nervous and anxious and off you go. So it's a broad question, but I'm hoping you have tips.
It is a broad question. So let me just start at the beginning, which is to say that a lot of fear and nervousness in interviews is caused by not feeling prepared. So you're afraid of where this might go. And so most of the time you can allay at least some of that nervousness by doing your homework. And there's some tough questions you have to ask yourself when you begin to prepare for an interview. The one that I have my staffers do when I'm doing things for public radio is they have to be able to answer this question. Why this person at this time on this subject? And if you answer all three sections of that question, then you basically have your thesis statement. You know what this interview is about. Mm-hmm. So starting from the end back on this subject. So what is important about this particular topic? Is there an aspect of this issue that's not getting enough attention? It's not well enough understood. What kind of impact does it have on people? The subject itself has to have some kind of stakes to it. And then you go to at this time. And this is, you guys know, this is what journalists call a peg, right? And we get those interviews often because our book just came out. Mm-hmm. that just happened. That's why they're doing the interview with us. But there needs to be a reason why you're talking about it right now. And the final thing is why this person. And people sort of skip over this question, but it's really important because what does this person have to tell you that nobody else can? You could talk to a thousand different economists, but what is this economist's specialty? Or what is their experience in their life that is unlike anyone else's? That's going to be the focus of your interview, because in any interview, what you're looking for is surprise. If there's no surprise in the interview, what's the point? Like, if people can listen to an interview and they can kind of know where it's going or know about what's going to be said through most of the thing, they may enjoy it, but it's still going to be background music. It's still going to be something that they will easily turn away from to focus on something else. But if you're wondering where this is going, or somebody says something and you say, whoa, I didn't expect that. That kind of surprise is what keeps people engaged and keeps them coming back, by the way, in terms of loyalty to a program. So what that means in terms of your homework is that you need to find out what has this person never been asked. You know, there's this great story, A.J. Liebling, who is a legendary writer for The New Yorker. At one point, he got an interview with Willie Shoemaker. Willie Shoemaker is the famous horse jockey. And he was also, Shoemaker was very well known for A, not doing interviews. And when he did interviews, he gave like one word answers. So Liebling started the interview with this question. He said, why do you ride with one stirrup higher than the other? And Willie Shoemaker, yeah, Willie Shoemaker was A, so anxious to answer that question and so impressed that Liebling had noticed it that he got a good interview out of Willie Shoemaker, which is shocking. And there's another example. Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, when he met the Dalai Lama, the first question he asked him was, were your parents allowed to come with you when you went up the mountain, you know, to become the Dalai Lama? And the Dalai Lama couldn't wait to answer that question. He'd never been asked before. No one had thought this through of what that would have been like for a young boy to leave his parents.
Right.
Huh. That's
yeah. Those are great examples.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And actually, I just realized it's why Sean Evans at Hot Ones. I don't know if you've ever watched that. He eats hot wings and interviews people, and you know that's part of his shtick is it throws people off balance because they're eating really hot wings. But he also does unbelievable research, and he almost always gets someone laughing and saying, oh my gosh, how did you know that? Or how did you find that? Or whatever. And it's the reason it's so compelling as an interview and the reason that, you know, people are so interested in doing that show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially when you get people who are interviewed a lot, they answer the same questions over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, I find when I'm researching someone and I try to read and listen to all of their interviews and I realize, oh my gosh, are they as bored as I am? Just, you know, I'm not here. And then there'll be that one question that's different. I mean, you know, what I mean is like when I'm listening to all of their research and I'm realizing, wait, if I'm bored hearing the same answers over and over again, they've got to be bored giving the same answers over and over again. But it's just because no one's asking them anything new or different. So, you know, and you can hear when someone, especially on those, like when you see people doing those press junkets for movies, you can tell that they're answering the same question over and over and over again because their eyes have got that kind of glazed over, you know, look to them. There's no life to it. And then you can tell when they get a cool or a different question. And it's just a different ball game at that point.
I was watching a hockey game the other night, and at the end of it, they popped the coach up in front of the, you know, the flag with his team on it or something, and some journalist says, "Coach, what do you think?" It was the winning coach. "Coach, what do you think made the difference tonight?" And he said, "We scored more goals than the other team." It's just like...
I know.
I thought that was beautiful. I was like, yep, that's probably what it was.
I did an interview with Melissa Etheridge, the singer, one time. And the first question I asked her is, I was like, "Listen, I hear you're obsessed with puzzles, but how do you keep your kids out of them?" And she totally started cracking up. She's like, "Oh my God, you have no idea how hard," because her kids were little at that point, you know, and they were constantly getting their fingers. She'd spend all this time on a puzzle and they'd go in and just. So if you do your homework to the point at which you find that surprise, you will be shocked, A, at how much better the interview goes, that your guest will open up like a flower, and B, you'll feel better.
And it'll be more
fun. Right, because you've connected.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got one last question for you, which is, how did a music major and musician realize that having a lovely and lyrical voice with which to sing could also translate to having a lovely and lyrical voice with which to be a radio journalist?
I didn't.
Okay.
You're assuming I like to hear myself on the radio, and that is just bunk. I did not realize that. It was complete and total chance. After I finished graduate school, my fiance was overseas. He was in Kosovo. He was in the army. And I was there as a single parent with an infant, and I needed a job. And I was at a radio station, and a friend of mine that I went to college with said, "Celeste, do you want a job?" I said, "Yes."
"Why, yes. What is it doing?"
Exactly. That's pretty much it. And she trained me to be a classical music host. It's very difficult to find good classical music hosts. They need a very in-depth knowledge of classical music so they can say interesting stuff that doesn't sound stupid or boring. Like, "Well, actually, of course, that was Bach's cantata." And then they need to be able to pronounce all those names, but they also need to have their radio chops. And it's much easier to train the radio part than the music part. So I could not stand to listen to myself. It was painful for years. I can listen. I can listen now, but I don't enjoy it.
When I have to listen for transcription, like when I'm transcribing my own interviews, Tim said, without fail, at some point, I'm going to yell, "Oh my gosh, just shut up."
Because I know.
Yeah. My early interviews are so embarrassing. It has improved, but oh my goodness, there is an NPR host in particular that I just cringe every time I think about interviewing him. Two of them that
I don't know how you guys feel, but there comes a point, and for me, it's like earlier and earlier as I go on in years, when I'm just sick of myself. Yeah. Like when I go on a book tour, like pretty early on, I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm just I can't stand anything I have to say. I'm sick of it. I've had enough of myself." It happens pretty fast.
Yeah, I remedy that a little bit by making sure I do one new thing every single time I get on stage. I have to make sure there's just something new in there every single time. But yeah, I definitely get sick of it. So sick of myself.
It gets hard. So. In just a minute, I'm going to tell Celeste what I've been reading lately, because oddly enough, it goes exactly into the story that she just told us about standing in a radio station in a foreign country and being asked, "Do you want a job?" But before we do that, let's take a minute to hear from a sponsor. Hello again. Hashtag AmWriting is proud to be sponsored by Dabble, software for writers that doesn't require an instruction manual. We're in love with Dabble's plotting tool, so easy and intuitive, but we should also mention that Dabble always backs up your work and works everywhere and on every device. So you can zip in and take a look at your big picture or your plot points wherever you are and whenever you're thinking about your book, and maybe get in a word or two, too. Get a free trial at dabblewriter.com. Okay. So now we're going to move on to what we like to call hashtag am reading. And I do have my recommendation, which I'm totally excited about. I'm clutching it to my hot little chest here, excited to share it. But before I do, Celeste, we always let the guest go first. What have you been reading?
So I could not recommend more reading the book by Studs Terkel, published in 1992, called Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. This book, more than almost any other I've ever read, and I've read all of them, okay, helped me understand race in a way that I never had before. And again, I'm speaking as a Black Jew who's, you know, a very, very small part Native American as well. It was absolutely eye-opening and enlightening, and I am stunned that at this moment in our history, the country is not turning to this book to get a better idea. He interviews Emmett Till's mother, all kinds of people all over the country, to sort of see, here's what you think about race. And the thing you come away with is a realization that there's no such thing as an authority on race and racism. It doesn't exist. And the reason for that is because all of us have our own personal experience and interaction with racial identity. And therefore, we're all experts in our own racial identity, but no one else's, which means we have to talk to other people if we're going to get any kind of better understanding. It's great.
Oh, I'm in, because I think the last thing of Studs Terkel that I even dipped into was Working. So I'm ready for some more Studs Terkel.
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah. It's so good.
KJ, do you want to save yours to last and keep it there on your, as you said, your hot little chest?
On your bosom?
Yeah, that's it. All right, that was
your
a little
hot
weird.
Little chest.
Hot little, I'm just, yeah, the rest of me is super hot, too. I'm smoking over here. Yeah, just putting it out there because there's no video. Just trust me on this. I'm looking good. Yeah, I'm going to wait for last.
Okay. Mine's super easy. I'm still in the comfort re-listening place. I've had to read on the page a lot for work. And so my audiobook listening has all been about the comfort stuff. And because we've been talking about education a lot lately, I've been using the term magical thinking a lot lately. And so I actually went back and picked up Augustine Burroughs' Magical Thinking, which led me to listen to Augustine Burroughs' Lust and Wonder, which made me pick up Toil and Trouble again, a book that KJ had tipped me off to when it first came out. And it's just been a really nice thing to listen to while I'm in the garden. And I'm all about the comfort listens, because sometimes when things get icky, a little Jane Austen, a little David Sedaris can make me feel so much better.
Yeah, definitely. That's funny, because I was actually looking for Toil and Trouble just the other day, and I don't think I kept my copy. So the library it is, because I'm certainly not going to buy it twice.
I picked it back up for the part where he talks about not having the house yet, but having the dog for the house, because that's exactly what I would do. He went ahead and got the dog because he was so so positive with all of his wonderful magical thinking and that the house was going to work out well. That's so me.
Yeah. I love it. All right. Well, so here's my recommendation. I just finished the book Motherland by Leah Frankie, and it is about a young woman who somewhat impulsively marries a man from Kolkata who lives in Mumbai, and moves there with him in part. And she's pretty honest about this from the get-go, in part because she's not quite sure what to do with her life, and he is so very, very certain about what to do with his. So she moves there, and within a couple of weeks of her idea is that she's a foodie, she's a cook, she loves to cook, she's going to experience the foods of Mumbai, she's going to do all this great stuff, she's going to, you know, experience the culture. And instead, her mother-in-law shows up unexpectedly, having left her husband, which is not something that is done in Kolkata, which is where her mother-in-law is from, and moves in with them, and then her husband moves out. So she and her mother-in-law have to come together, and her mother-in-law is also a point of view character in this book. And it is so well done. And at the beginning, you kind of hate them both. And by the end, you definitely love them both. And it does not progress in expected ways. But the reason that you reminded me of it, Celeste, is that she becomes desperate for a job, any job. And someone turns her on to being a voiceover artist for TV soaps, which are huge in India. People love them. So she ends up as a voiceover artist for this massive, you know, 4 years worth of episodes soap called something like, you know, Mary's. It doesn't even matter. But it just reminded me when you said, give me a job, any job. Anyway, right. It's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it.
Ooh, I'm going to seek it out in audio, I can already tell.
I bet it's good audio.
Yeah,
I bet it's really interesting as audio. If they did it right, it ought to be good audio. And it's definitely definitely well done and fascinating. So, well, that's it for us today. Before we sign off, let's see, I'll start by saying CelesteHeadley.com if you want to hear more about our guest. And her books, once again, are Do Nothing, How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving, and We Need to Talk, How to Have Conversations That Matter. Both are really important reads for this moment that we find ourselves in.
All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause, stop, stall.